Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you.
Help, I need somebody. Help.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery.
I need someone.
Hello and welcome to Real Recovery. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio, and just across the way, a man who gets up in the morning and then has limited activities, George P. Fraser. Hello, George.
Bill, I try to keep my mornings open and my afternoons open in case something comes up.
Exactly. And after your sister, you were your mom's favorite, weren't you?
No, I think the dogs and maybe the canary. Yeah.
You guys had a canary growing up?
Yeah, my sister had a minor bird, too.
Did it talk?
It did.
Okay. That's interesting. Well, we got a great show tonight. We're going to bring Peter Wohler on in just a minute, and we're going to talk about how important it is to have a recovery plan in action, ready to go. Because if you don't have a plan and you don't have something that you are actively doing, it's quite possible you can slip back into old patterns, old lifestyles.
Yeah, and I think that's very important, Bill. And as you know, because you're on the show with me every week, and thank God we're going into our 10th year. What a blessing.
Well, 11th year. Yeah, 11th in March.
Well, who keeps tracking?
I don't.
You didn't do as many drugs as I did, so your memory's better. Okay, anyway, so the plan for recovery isn't ours. We made a decision in step three to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood him. We understand him to be Jesus. God has a plan for your recovery, and he's touched your heart. That's why you want to actually try this. He convicted you and is also offering you help. What is your recovery plan? Well, listen to the people God brought into your life to share that with you. But the one thing we always go to, Bill, is one of the great things, one of the great miracles, and it is a miracle anytime anybody gets saved and sober, and we should never forget that, is that God doesn't help us get saved and sober without having a job for us to do. And I know a little bit about tonight's guest, and he's all over that.
Yeah.
What a great life. But really what your recovery is, it's God's call on your life to share him maybe with people that have the same problem you do, maybe at work, what God's done in your life to bring you out of your recovery. The steps aren't our way of lifting ourselves out of recovery. They're God's way of showing us how to get in contact with him to have him do it. And all the steps do is get your ego out of your recovery so you can be filled with the Holy Spirit. That's all they do when we do them. But if you do them, they're a great discipline to help you get there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so one of the questions is, are you open to guidance? Are you open to accepting help?
Not really, Bill.
Why? I wasn't talking
you
to you.
Help me with?
Yeah.
I've always found that kind of input overrated, as a matter of fact.
I get it.
But as the Big Blue Recovery Book says, we were beaten into a state of reasonableness.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the more willing we get is proportional to how beat up we are. And you can hear God, I think C.S. Lewis said that God shouts to us in our pain, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we find that to be true. So if you want to talk about your willingness to do God's will, look at your willingness to listen to other people and also your willingness to do what they suggest to you. Because if God's sovereign, which he is, he brought these people into your life to give you a message. And for me, when I subordinate my desires to God's, I listen to other people, Bill. And part of being in a community is having people that have your permission to give you feedback, whether you want to hear it or not. And usually we want to hear the good feedback, but not the negative.
Mm-hmm. So being part of community, just really critical. If you've gone through a treatment or you have had a period of sobriety, it's critical that you stay in community and have a plan.
Right. And usually that involves doing what you need to do to grow more Christ-like, but also where are you helping others?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. If you are not serving others in some capacity, you're sitting around thinking about yourself too much, and that's never good, is it, George?
I wasn't looking for any feedback there, Bill, but thank
you. I wasn't
pointing
any fingers, but I was kind of looking your direction.
I could tell that. Yeah, and occasionally we need that nudge, don't we?
Occasionally, yeah, yeah. So I'm always excited to bring in new guests, new stories, and I think Peter's background is not necessarily one of it's not one of personal use, but it's one of coming alongside people who are struggling, drugs, alcohol, sex trafficking. He's the real deal that he's on the front line every day.
And it ties in with recovery, that service work and helping others is where we want to get to in our recovery. And if you think you have a good recovery and you're not doing that, you don't.
Yep. Yep. So we'll take a little break. When we come back, we'll bring in our special guest, Peter Weller. You are listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George. Got Ryan on the board tonight, as always. So we're going to take a very short break and be right back.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery.
Welcome back to Real Recovery, Bill and George. We're so glad to have Peter Weller, also known as the dreaded pastor, in studio with us tonight. And when I say dreaded, it means he's got dreadlocks, and it's really cool. And I think it's really cool. We're going to talk tonight again, George, about just the recovery resources and what's available, and how do you get through recovery, you know, after treatment? If you don't do certain things, you're going to end up in the old neighborhoods and end up in the old lifestyle.
It's really, you have to change your whole life. And it happens gradually for most people, but it's a big change, Bill. And let's face it, most people don't make it.
Yeah. So, Peter, welcome to the show.
Oh, great to be here.
Yeah. And I just want to first start off saying, A, you've got a powerful ministry and you have an incredible personal story that mirrors something that George has, because you're also a cancer survivor and you were facing really an end of life sentence not that long ago. Tell our listeners a little bit about that.
Well, about 4 years ago, November 7th, to be exact, I was told I had 30 to 60 days to live. And
30 to 60.
30 to 60. And it was after a diagnosis that happened in August in stage 4 lower bowel cancer. Went through some chemo. It didn't work, and had some operations, and ended at the end of that. And they said, there's nothing else we can do for you. Mm. And so we were in that season of praying for a miracle while planning a funeral.
Mm-hmm.
And January 7th, I call my 2018 my expiration date. And so now we're, near like 1,490 days past my expiration date, and we'll take it.
I love it. I love it. Georgia, it's always encouraging to hear those stories. You've got one just pretty much like it.
You know, I think it is, and I think it's one of the things about this show, Peter, is for people to hear when they're trying to get sober that people actually make it. And I know for me, when I got diagnosed, I really hung on to the stories that I heard from people that were still alive, because it shows it's possible. And with God, all things are possible.
Amen. Amen. Yeah, it's a season like no other. It's one I can truly say I would not want to have gone through it, and I would not wish it upon anybody at the same time.
Yeah. So.
Well, I think you... really find out what you believe in, that it's not just a nice thought that you intellectually believe. You either know that your faith in God is real or not. And it's one of those things for me anyway, that sure, I know I'm going to die and get to heaven. Would you have it on the calendar? Totally different deal, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh no, it does bring what's important about life. You know, and I'm sure this is the same with you. There's been so many people, and we still get many people. You know, this morning I got an email from friends of friends that are going through similar situations or early diagnosis. And, you know, it shakes you. And it's been an opportunity to come in close contact with those people and not just share my story, but just, you know, share what's going to happen when you die. You know, just to ask that question.
You guys, I'd love for you to share some PET scan stories. How do you guys anticipate those?
Oh, for myself, I get CT scans.
Okay.
I've graduated to 6-month scans.
Okay.
So I had 3-month scans from 2017 up until spring of this year, and now I got my last scan was a 6-month scan, and it's all clear. So I've been clear for a year and a half.
Nice.
And you know, it for me, I go to Rochester Mayo Clinic, and I was going there every 3 weeks for 3.5 years, and so now when I go back, it's nostalgic in a bit because you go back to the same places and the same lab rooms and scan rooms, and it reminds you of when you were in a state when you didn't know, you know, and a state where my clothes fit a little better because I was about 60 pounds lighter, but don't suggest that diet on anybody. But but truly, you know, it is thankfully a place of just really a celebration and gratitude toward God for where we are now, mm-hmm. you know. But it does bring me back, I think, in a very positive way, you know. Doesn't bring back a lot of fear, but just, again, just going through that season and being grateful. People would say, hey, keep battling cancer, and I'd always be like, I wish I could while I was going through it. I wish I could grab a sword or hit something, but it just happened to me, and I was at the mercy of it. But I was also at the mercy of God's healing. Mm-hmm. I didn't do anything for it. And God healed me upon his mercy, and I'm just incredibly grateful for that.
Yeah. George, what about you when it comes to scans?
Oh, wow. Gosh, that was so well said. I found for me that the day of the scan, I'm fine. Okay. But now, when you brought this up, Arnold.
Thank you, by the way.
It was great. I have one, I think, March 1st. When I think about that ahead of time, I get a little anxious.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I'm still going in for my infusion immunotherapy treatments.
Mm.
When I go back there, you're right. It's like going back to treatment. It brings it all back, and I see the people that are sick and dying.
Mm-hmm.
And when I get done, I remove the bandages in the bathroom and walk out. I don't have it. I'm not wrapped tight enough mentally. I'm not looking for any feedback, but I know I'll get a lot of men from Arnold to really process this. I live like I don't have it. And I go take care of it and turn it over to God because I'm not capable. But if I get ahead of today, Matthew 6:34, do not worry about tomorrow. Each day has enough trouble of its own. There's something magical about projecting in the future. I feel like I go without God when I do that. Can't prove it to you, but my level of serenity does. And I'm amazed. One of the things about, you know, fighting it, I remember Peter, a lot of people said, well, you know, if you're positive, you can beat this. And I remember thinking, you know, 11-year-old kids don't die from cancer because they're too negative. You know, you show up, or I'll hear now, well, you know, George beat cancer. I didn't have a plan B on this. Nobody does. It's totally out of your control.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've said that before in my life, but the first time that ever happened to where I got it, it's kind of like I believed in God, but now I know there's a God. The experience has been the biggest blessing ever.
Mm-hmm.
But like you, now that I've had the blessing, I'd like it to go in the rearview mirror. and God is sovereign. And my sponsor, my mentor, said to me one time, do you trust God? And I go, of course. And he said, well, start acting like it. And I thought, that's so harsh, but that's such good truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And what I realized is I didn't.
Hmm.
Does God really love me? Do I want to live a day longer than he has willed for me? I don't know. What do you think about that?
You know, the something you said just clicked with me. My cancer story really starts with my oldest sister dying from cancer in 2009. And so back then, I didn't know really anything about cancer. Her husband's a doctor. Our family is a family of faith. In fact, 9 months before she passed away, we saw a miraculous healing of visible tumors after a prayer time. And she went to the doctor, and they did scans, and they're like, we can't explain it. It's gone. Mm. And there was a lot of celebration. There was a supernatural, bona fide miracle. 4 months later, Christmas time, it came back.
Mm-hmm.
5 months after that, she passed away. And so, part of, going into this, I think the thing for us, we had four kids, 8 to 16 at the time. And so, so that's our whole world of figuring out. And the idea of them going, part of their childhood without their dad was just like, oof, that was the thing that was, I couldn't imagine anything worse in the world. And so to explain to them, we're not sure it's going to happen. And we used Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and their theme of just saying to the king, hey, we believe God can save us. And the second thing is, we really hope he does. But the third thing they said was, and if he doesn't, he's still a good God. And that message, I think at that time, was probably my main concern, that my kids would hear that. But like you said, a little bit, it's surreal now in 2021. But it comes back to, okay, God, you're in control. My sister being healed 9 months earlier was a miracle, but I don't know if that was more powerful than walking with her right next to her for the last 3 months as she walked and said, okay, it's time to go be with Jesus. And the amount of people she touched, she affected, including myself, is just, I don't know if she would have ministered to more people in the next 20 years if she would have lived to be 80 or not.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting when you think of Jesus bringing Lazarus back from the dead. I don't know if we know exactly how many years or how much time Lazarus had when he came back from the dead until he died again.
Yeah.
But that story is powerful, and I'm just curious, how have you changed the way you think? What are some ways of thinking that you've stopped doing since your experience? And that question is for both of you. I feel like I'm interviewing you guys.
You are.
Yeah.
And I think, George, he wanted you to start.
Yeah, I always want George to start. I think you kind of have in a way, George. You've said, this brought my faith exactly to the forefront of my head and my heart. And you now know that God is absolutely real, and your faith is real, and that's a pretty powerful testimony. If you weren't thinking that before, not that you weren't.
I think what it did for me, and I can only speak for me, is that it made it more of a reality. In that, I believed in Jesus since I think my whole life, but it became a Christian in high school. But it was kind of not an everyday constant reality. And what I mean is, I thought about it during the day, but not totally intensely all the time. And when I got cancer, that changed.
Mm-hmm.
The stakes were raised, and we're going to meet face to face. I was never mad. I was really sad. And I thought that I my theology was off, and I would never verbalize this, but I always thought, since I was a Christian, nothing really bad's going to happen to me. I don't know where I got that, but I had that. Well, this was a bad thing, because I was going to die. And what happened is, I'm coughing up blood here one day, and that's shocking. You can't deny that. You can't, rationalize that away. And I thought, this is bad. Keep breathing. And a thought came into my head. I believe it was God speaking to me. He said, I got you. I've always had you. I helped you get sober. And I've got you now. It's going to be okay. And I thought, you know what? Once again, I missed it. Bill, once again, I missed it. This is an opportunity for me. I'm going to die anyway, but I get time to say goodbye to people. How many people are taken in a car crash or suddenly I get to have the final farewell tour. And then it was like going on a long trip to see my parents. I thought I was going on a cruise. Now I got better, but what happened was God showed up and I went from total despair to instant peace and gratitude. So I can tell you that what you believe is true. I know it because I've experienced it. And I don't know how to verbalize that properly, but my blessing from cancer wasn't that I got better, although that's a very close second. My blessing is that I got to see the God that I believe in is totally real. And I can't verbalize that. How about you, Peter? What was it like?
Well, I think, you know, the thing that, I think of with that question is now 4 years later is just that where I am weak, he is strong. And, you know, speaking to that, you know, you're in this season, you talked about a farewell tour. And I experienced that too. I mean, I had elementary school friends I'd never seen, you know, show up at my doorstep wonderfully. I had my high school basketball team. They all came. I mean, just different things like that. Just the old band got back together, you know, just literally, you know, stuff like that. And it was quite a blessing. But I work with Source of Men, and we had our banquet. It was our highest attended banquet ever. it was in November. So people, the word got out. And so so the thought was, this was going to be the last time you're going to see Peter. Yeah. I mean, that was just the reality, you know. And so we kind of chuckled that one of these years I'm going to put out a vague Caring Bridge message that, you know, got news from the doctor, can't share now, just before the banquet, just to see if the attendance will spike. But that thing about where we are weak, he is strong. And, you know, don't have time to go into it, but our organization Source was the victim resource coordinators for the Super Bowl in January here in Minneapolis of 2018. And we had so many plans and so many things were going to be done that fall, which still happened, but without me.
Yeah, you got.
So I was down on my back. Our staff was doing it. And I'm usually the point person for our staff. And truthfully, you know, that whole thing of where we're weak, we're strong, I've come to much realization. You know, as much as I like to think I'm mature in the Lord and I have lots of discerning and identity things don't value, you know, I don't think about. It was just a whole new level of, okay, this is totally yours, God. You know, this today is totally yours. This ministry is totally yours. And it's not how incredible I am and how innovative for the kingdom I am and, you know, how radical I am. It comes back to God. Man, when I figure out ways to just get out of the way, oof, you do incredible things.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a little break. I know we've gotten off to an interesting start hearing your stories, but when we do come back, we're going to talk about recovery resources and how important community is for support and encouragement. And we'll be right back with our special guest, Peter Woller, in just a minute.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery.
Welcome back to Real Recovery, Bill and George. Of course, Ryan is on the board as always. And we've got Peter Woller as our guest tonight. And quite a riveting conversation you two have had so far about your shared experiences with cancer. So thank you for that. I do, because we, you know, that fits into the narrative of any kind of recovery mm-hmm. story, because you are recovering from both of you staring yes. down the end of life. So those are powerful stories. So thank you for that. Peter, I do want to hear more about your ministry and how you work with people that are very much struggling with drugs and homelessness and everything else,
yeah.
and what you see as some of the problems and what you see as some of the solutions.
Yeah, me and my wife have been part of Source of Men for about 25 years, since 95. And the focus initially was all around at-risk youth and young adults. And so homeless youth, teens in prostitution. In the 90s, you had a lot of different cultures within what we call gutter punks or goths. And, you know, that those labels don't really pertain anymore. But there's still a lot of at-risk youth, at-risk young people. And so our focus was on both combined doing outreach, making contact and gaining trust against a group that was, you know, had a lot of walls up, you know, this combination of being on their own for the first time, but also out of a lot of brokenness, broken homes, addictions, and a lot of abuse. And, you know, initially our heart was just to kind of reach a counterculture missionally. I had just been with Youth with a Mission for a year overseas. And, you know, we just saw this Minneapolis is my Jerusalem. And so it's like, hey, we're going, our mission field are the kids that are now coming to churches. And then along with that, you started seeing lots and lots of dysfunction. And, you know, one of the initial things for us starting a house is that we were interacting with homeless youth, and we'd have Bible studies, and we'd see individuals make positive choices of rededicating their life, receiving Christ, wanting to get out of their situation. And you'd have wonderful Bible studies where, you know, again, this non-studious, rebellious, really rough-looking crowd, you know, sometimes to tears in prayer times. And then they go home, but there's one problem. They don't have a home. And there's this over-daunting feeling of seeing that kid leave and just like, I know where they're going. They're squatting at a house or they're going to a specific area of town. And so for us, it was like, okay, well, there's just a really logical solution here. We got to provide a place for them to stay, a transitional home, a halfway house of some sort. And that was kind of the initial thing. And we've been doing transitional homes since June of 1995. And it's been a place, sometimes a halfway house after treatment, a transitional time. Sometimes it's been a way to get into treatment, meaning we'd have an individual that would, yeah, I dabble in a chemical or alcohol, but it's not a big deal. And so, okay, so, you know, they desire to change their life and they're going to come live. Well, part of the rules are you have to be sober and get a job. And sometimes within a few weeks, they realize they can't do that. But now, for the first time, when they're on their own, there's not really a motivation to go to treatment. But now they've kind of came to a point where they've voiced to people that care about them, I want to change. And now I realize I'm out of control and I can't. And so sometimes we'd be a step to the treatment and then the step after treatment, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and you know, and for us, you know, how that developed is this idea of the need for recovery resources. Because with a lot of at-risk young people, they're coming out of pretty rough situations. And, you know, one simple stat, unfortunately, is foster kids in America, 40% will be homeless within the first year of them becoming 18. And so once they turn 18, they're not a ward of the state anymore. So they're completely on their own. I hate to think if I was completely on my own when I was across the street here at Northwestern and, you know, turning all my socks and underwear pink because I washed them with a red shirt. You know, I didn't know what I was doing.
Right.
But they have nowhere to fall back to. There's no safety net. So they become homeless at an alarming rate. And along with that, you know, gets in, you know, there's within our city, within 48 hours, homeless youth, which are individuals under 21, within 48 hours, they'll be approached someone from the drug or the sex industry. So there's just an incredible amount of trappings and ways to fall through the cracks in our culture. And so to provide a place that they can make that recovery is so significant. But then also that speaks to the recovery resources that we had talked about.
Yeah, George, isn't that an alarming statistic? Within 48 hours, if you're under 21, you'll be approached by someone in the drug or sex trafficking community.
Totally. Shocking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, part of, I think, a lot of the awareness over the last 10 years, this isn't something just in India or China or in Miami or New York. You know, we have lots of stories of even suburban trafficking. You know, right now there's a national story out of Minneapolis of an individual that was 30 years old trafficking minors. And these kids are from the suburbs going to private schools. There's six girls that are involved with this that Source was directly involved with. And so it is something, unfortunately, isn't just a part of an inner city impoverished culture.
Mm-hmm.
It is global.
What are some of the things parents should be look out for that's happening with their kids that they might have raised eyebrows about? They show up with a new cell phone, something like that.
Oh, exactly. I mean, so if you know, some of and actually this happened with, just use this story, the mom called us because she noticed her daughter had a new cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
And she noticed there was a couple hundred dollars in her daughter's bank account that had no reason, you know, she didn't know where it came from. And so she started investigating, and then her daughter had some new shoes. So having gifts, mm-hmm. you know, also signs of if there's new people their daughters or individuals are hanging out with, if they're cutting off old friends, if they seem to be, and part of this, you could say, well, this is sometimes natural teenage behavior, but, you know, cutting off times with family, any type of, you know, suspicious different behavior that's happening. Unfortunately, you can say the predators involved with trafficking really hone in on the insecurities of an individual that is looking for belonging and looking for value. So someone that gets into trafficking is you know, somewhat brainwashed or somewhat lured into it, that is really speaking to their insecurities. And then once they get engaged with it and they get connected with the individual that is giving them affirmation, that is speaking to their belonging, also giving them physical gifts, you know, then it just turns worse and worse. And then sometimes, you know, addiction of drugs, they're introduced to, you know, small chemicals or small drugs, if you want to use that term, and then the addiction gets greater. And then eventually it gets to a point of, okay, if you want to go back, but guess what? You're going to get in trouble for all the things we've been doing, you know. And to take that to even a further extent, you know, there's some pimps that have children with women, or women are single moms, and then the pimps are like, go ahead, turn me in. Go live in a shelter. They'll take away your kids. I'll turn you in. And more, you know, just talking about trafficking, it is turning to our judicial system. The police that are involved, the investigators, are seeing women as victims versus than criminals. 10 years ago, most of the time, you know, women in prostitution trafficked would be treated like drug dealers. A lot of times the church treat them that way as far as how they view them. They can get out if they want to. But more and more they're treated like victims. And the desire is to help these individuals get out.
You know, George, one of the things that we have learned over the decade we've been doing Real Recovery is something Peter just said, that, you know, you have these insecurities and you're going to scramble to try to find a way to deal with your insecurities. And for a lot of people who have been on the show and told their stories, it started when they were 11 or 12. They didn't feel like they fit in. They were awkward. They felt lonely. So yeah, this helped them feel a little bit more confident.
Yeah, you always talk about we need to join a club or have a group or yeah, have a community. And I think you're going to find it. And a lot of times it's not a healthy one.
Yeah, no, you will definitely find it, right? That's one of our basic needs, to belong.
Oh, yeah.
Right? To seek love without strings. And so, unfortunately, if you don't find it in what I believe is the God-given healthy ways that he created us to find it, within family and with the spiritual community that is for you and will protect you and that will love you without strings, when that's not present, you go out and find it in dysfunctional communities that either very knowingly or even sometimes unknowingly are just trying to get their own needs met. And then as a result, you become the victim of those abuses that can span a lifetime.
And when drugs and alcohol come into the picture, and there's sex trafficking on top of that, when the need for the drugs are what they are, you're going to be doing whatever it takes to get the drugs. It's just, it's a horrific evil.
Yeah. And, you know, part of it, the sense of normal, if I can use that word, is so, you know, there's times we've had 19-year-olds in our transitional home for women who are dancers, and they got pregnant, and their parents kicked them out of the house for the reason they were no longer the breadwinners of the family, and they couldn't dance anymore. You know, wow. I mean, it's like, you know, you hear stories like that, and like, I just cannot relate to your parent being in that situation. Are you being in that situation? So normal is so different, and there are very few, you know, terrible situations where women are chained to beds in basements. You know, that is not the vast majority of trafficking. That doesn't mean the idea of, well, they can get out if they want to. You know, they're realizing the walls that are there are significant for women that have gone through such immense trauma, is part of the reality of trying to provide and empower individuals, not just healing, but able to get out and stay out.
Mm-hmm. Now, Peter, when you do work with younger men who are involved in drugs, alcohol, what do you find to be their trajectory? Do they find a way out, or do they?
It really is, I'll transition to recovery resources, because I think that is so significant. So if I can just use our definition of that real quick, you
sure.
know, the whole idea of recovery resources, and if you Google, sometimes capital resources is the chemical dependency term, but it's the general idea that after treatment, okay, and treatment is sometimes a 30-day to a 18-month season,
mm-hmm.
okay? And if you're talking with trafficking victims, you know, there's sometimes there is a longer, and there's like a real needed thing for that, and a lot of times individuals thrive in that. They get three meals a day. They're scheduled. Hopefully it's a program that's affirming them, that's talking about their worth and value. If it's a faith-based program, they're talking about how God made them and wants to redeem their life. And they're getting that support 24 hours a day. Well, there comes a day where they leave that. And what research really shows is that the individual that's able to not just maintain a recovery lifestyle and remain substance-free, but able to have a positive trajectory is the individual that has recovery resources. And really, that's twofold. One, it's a community of encouragement and support. And two, it's opportunity with life skills, education, and career. And I know us three know individuals that got sober 40 years ago, and they went through treatment. And they had a family that was going to support their sobriety. They had a safe home to live in, and they had a job waiting for them. Their boss even told them, you get done with this treatment, there's a job waiting for you. And they had those things of recovery resources and were able to maintain. And decades later, that is something that is a part of their past. Well, for young adults that we're talking about, and especially trafficking victims, they don't have those recovery resources. And so they end up in the same neighborhood, a lot of times the same house that got them there in the first place.
Wow.
And they end up in the lifestyle sometimes days, if not months later. And so that thing about recovery resources and how not just society, but how even the body of Christ, the church, can provide that is something that's very significant.
George, weigh in on that.
Well, I take it very simply, Bill. We always talk about your recovery has to be better than your using. Your life has to be better sober than it did using. And Peter, I always think of the analogy that Bill and I grew up in the suburbs. And if I'm a sober guy and I lose my house and it's a typical Minnesota winter and I'm living on the street, I don't think I'm sober because I'm cold. I'll drink to make myself feel better.
Yeah, numb yourself, and
totally. And so if your life isn't better after making a change like that, you're going to go back to it. And you need opportunity for hope that it's going to change. And if you lose all that, you lose your sobriety. You'd have to. And hope is in God, but we need something tangible that we're moving, as you guys use the word, trajectory. I need something I can measure that by.
Yeah.
Am I eating? Do I have a place to live? Do I have people who care about me? Do I have clothes? Am I cold? That kind of thing. Do I have an opportunity for education? Where am I going to go? We need hope.
Yeah. Do you still have teeth?
Yeah, I mean,
there's some health issues too that coming out of drugs that you might.
Well, that wasn't an age question for me.
No.
That...
no.
Okay.
No, but.
No, I think you're right, Bill. And I think, Peter, we have to get to a point where, okay, I'm going to do this because I'm going to get this.
Yeah.
We don't make changes. We're incentive based, right? I'm going to be better off doing this. And if you lose all hope, you don't have the recovery resource, you're in trouble.
Yeah. I know, Bill, you were just talking off air, right? And you work with Salvation Army of meeting people who've been through treatment a dozen times.
Yeah. The record down there was a guy who this was his 53rd attempt at rehab.
Yeah. And so people would say, well, that's ridiculous. Rehab must not be working. And I would say, I think the rehab works great. He's returning there. He wants something healthy, but it's the post-rehab that's not working.
Yeah.
He has no recovery resources after rehab.
I think that's such an important point.
Yeah. And so part of, you know, the model that we've adopted with our transitional homes, our heart is that, and we like the word, using the word transitional homes versus transitional housing, simply because home really communicates the real needs of the individual, of needing a family to belong to. So along with having a caseworker that helps individual with where they are with life skills, you know, we've had individuals that have never worked a washer and dryer. We have individuals that never had a checkbook or a bank account. I explained to a 27-year-old once about car insurance. He didn't believe me. Because we were talking about his budget, and he's going to get a car. It's like, you have to have car insurance. And I told him how much it would be. And he thought I was pulling his leg.
Mm-hmm.
So just basic life skills, but also, you know, caseworkers to help with that education and career piece. And we've had women in our transitional homes that have had college educations from St. Thomas all the way to, you know, 30-year-olds with a very low, like, fifth grade reading level type of stuff, and to internationals, right? So there's a whole gamut of life skills there. But then the second thing, that piece of a community for encouragement support, and our heart is to point people, you know, part of our program is around spiritual formation, that people understand the redemption that Christ offers and the love and forgiveness that God has. But then also that they would understand that the body of Christ can be a place of belonging that gives you value and worth.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is oftentimes a ton of stigma for someone coming out of addictions, mm-hmm. as well as trafficking with church. And they've had a lot of negative experiences, either directly or indirectly.
That's a big topic. Let's take a break and come back and talk about that some more. Peter Wohler is our guest. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George. We'll be right back.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Real Recovery.
We're back with Real Recovery. So glad you have joined us tonight. Peter Wohler is our guest, and we're having a fascinating conversation with recovery resources. What are we prepared to do once we get out of treatment? Are you prepared to be in community, in church? Do you have a job? Do you have a fellowship? Do you have a support group? Do you have a mentor? Are you doing all the right steps to create the best opportunity for long-term sobriety? And that is a fascinating topic. Peter and George, how are we doing when it comes to churches? Are we welcoming people from recovery? Do we have a landing place for them at church? Or are we feeling awkward about their arrival?
Well, for me... Bill, we used to work down at the Salvation Army. I know you're still down there. And for me, we'd get a lot of volunteers and well-meaning guys, friends of ours from the suburban churches who took the time to go down there. But they had a hard time connecting with the guys. The guys had a hard time connecting with them, I think. And I think as a recovering addict, what I see is Peter had talked about how church could look more like the recovery movements. There's a high level of acceptance there. And what I would always think about, and I'm in recovery, I'm a recovering cocaine addict, they have no idea how bad we are, these guys from the suburban churches. And I would say part of that is they have no idea how bad they are. And what I mean by that is we kind of can forget our own brokenness. You know, if we look good, we have good jobs and all that. There is no one righteous, not one. All have sinned and fall short of God. But we categorize in our mind that we're doing better than we are, and other people that we see that have sins maybe we don't have, which are worse than the ones we do, they're not doing nearly as well. And I think when you're on the other side of that as a recovering person going to maybe a big suburban church, you feel that. And I always say, if you're not in recovery, that might not be the best ministry for you to go to because you haven't walked it. Doesn't eliminate everybody, but I think people can be most helpful when they've walked the walk themselves. That's just my opinion.
And I understand and support that, George, and but I also want to just also throw kind of a caveat to that. In that, you know, there, and I know, I don't think you're saying that, you know, if you haven't been an alcoholic, you can't minister to an alcoholic. I've heard that before.
No, what I'm saying is every Christian should be in recovery from something.
That, I agree with that completely.
And if you're not working your own recovery, don't try to help somebody else work theirs. That's what I'm
right.
saying.
No,
so
no.
Thank
and,
you.
Right. It's just that reality of what we've, that we've been saved and that our humanity and our hearts, you know, we are really, you know, I think one of the things in working with the homeless, volunteering at shelters, having to wake people up at 4:30 in the morning so they can catch a bus by 5, so they can get out to a assembly line labor job by 6:30 in the outer suburbs and work all day and come back and still stay in that shelter. Being in the shelters, and a third of the people I talk to have a relationship with Christ that they profess. You know, it was like just a lot of that experience and nameless experience with addicts is realizing I'm not that far away from them. And I think a bit of that topic of, you know, can the church be effective? You know, I think we just got to really look at church culture. You know, I think for the church, you know, sometimes addictions and recovery, if it kind of fits a certain look or a certain model that's not too different from them, it's a fit. But the reality is people are messy. And so if you know, you don't quite fit in or it looks really, really messy, there's often a, well, that's really not a fit for us here. But you know what, that just wrapping this all up into recovery resources, I think the more, you know, part of our heart is, as we're working with both young addicts and women in trafficking, is we would introduce them and acclimate them to a church culture. And hopefully we can get them not just kind of attend it to check off the box, but attend it with volunteers and staff that share meals with them during the week, that are taking them to jobs during the week. And then as a result, if they move to Albuquerque, they can find a church that's a fit part of their recovery resources.
Because they've done it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they can find a group that's encouraging and supportive.
Yeah. Peter, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for being
on
the
thanks
show.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a blast. Georgie Boy, that wraps up another award-winning episode of Real Recovery.
Thanks, Peter. That was great.
Yeah.
Bless you guys.
Have a great night, everyone, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.